Hello, I'm Alan Kohler, founder of Eureka Report, finance presenter on ABC News and columnist for The New Daily.
And I'm James Thompson, senior Chanticleer columnist at the Australian Financial Review.
And we are The Money, Money Cafe. And we're not in the cafe because I'm a bit crook. I've got a cold. So I didn't want to give it to James, did I?
Thank you, Alan.
You're welcome. what have you been up to this week?
Well, I've spent a bit of time in the last week listening to the Star inquiry. I love a casino inquiry, and this has been more great fun, I must say.
What I love about the Star thing is that the people who were supposed to clean it up made it dirtier.
Well, yes.
Isn't that what happened? Yes. Is that the summary of what happened?
Well, not quite. I think what's happened is the people who have been tasked with cleaning it up have realized just how big a challenge cleaning it up is, and also how financially debilitating cleaning it up is. And so they've started to turn on their regulator, essentially, including the now executive chairman and the former CEO of Star, discussing a way to sue the special manager that the regulator had appointed to the business. So it's all got pear-shaped. You can understand why the regulators lost confidence in the Star's ability to pull this turnaround off. And basically, you can understand in a way that the Star's chafing at the regulator's demands because they're thinking, hang on, we're still a business here. We've got to make some money.
The question that springs into my mind is a clean casino viable?
That is exactly the right question to ask, Alan, and I think at the moment the jury is out. If it's viable, it's pretty marginal.
Right. So a casino that's not, I don't know what you'd call it, laundering money and ripping people off and so on, is simply a low-margin utility.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, how about that? That's the danger.
Well, that's incredible, really. I mean, It is amazing. And I suppose that I wonder if it applies elsewhere in the world. Because they seem to be – I mean, well, Macau seems to be doing okay.
Well, no, Macau's going terribly.
I see. Right, okay.
Because they've cracked down on Chinese money in Macau. Vegas is still doing okay. What I don't know, the crackdown on money laundering and you know, that sort of nefarious behaviour has been one thing. The other part of the crackdown, particularly in New South Wales, is on problem gaming. So, you know, that they don't want people sitting around on pokies for 23 hours in a row, which is totally fair enough. But a bit of that was going on, or a degree of that was going on in the old world. So cleaning that up, you know, cutting off the free drinks in the high roller rooms, that all has an impact. And we're starting to see that.
Amazing. Amazing. Now, will Richard Goyder get voted off of the Woodside board?
No, he will not.
Right.
He will survive.
There's a few big shareholders who are against him, aren't they?
Yeah, there's a few big named shareholders, but most of them don't have massive stakes. So I think there'll be a substantial protest vote. Maybe it's 20, 25, even 30%, which won't be a nice feeling for Richard. But I think he survives. I think their climate action plan is stuffed. It will go down again.
Right. Well, it's not much of a plan. Let's face it. I mean, all they want to do is keep selling natural gas.
Yes. Well,
they don't want to transition at all.
Yeah. It is Woodside though. I mean, that's their business. Like this is the difficult thing, right, for Woodside and its investors. And this, I think this debate has been really healthy because it's made people think about what's Woodside on the tin? It's an oil and gas company. Yes, okay, it's going to transition over two decades, but over two decades, yes, it wants to keep selling lots of oil and gas, lots of it. For the next two decades.
But they need to have a two-decade plan, surely.
Absolutely, and they say they've got one. And their investors say, hang on, it's not good enough. This is exactly, I mean, you know, does Woodside need to change? Clearly, it's going to get a clear message on Wednesday that it needs to change. But
do you think they need to change to the extent of going to find some lithium or something?
I don't think that's viable for them. No. The lithium price is in the toilet, but B, you know, the capital, they got a lot of capital sunk into their business now. I mean, changing streams like that wouldn't necessarily be the greatest thing. Lithium mining is also pretty carbon intensive itself, of course.
That's true.
To me, this has been a great example of sort of where shareholder democracy works, you know. They say on climate votes, Woodside doesn't have to do this, but it sort of does because it can't lose the super funds as key investors. So it needs to prove to the super funds that it's moving. It put a crappy climate action plan out 2 years ago and that got voted down as it should have. Woodside's done a lot of work on the next one. It's spent a lot of time discussing the next one with its investors. The investors are saying, sorry, guys, still not good enough. We still need to see more. So I think this sort of tension is important and healthy, and this has been good. I think this whole fight should be celebrated because it's what we need to see at these big emitters.
What about the thing that Stephen Mayne keeps going on about, which is that someone like Richard Goyder, who's blotted his copybook at one company, has to quit the other company that he's on.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that. This will be his last term, so this is the final election he'll face at Woodside. So I guess to Stephen's point, he's out the door. I guess the question is, you know, as always the question at these when there's moments of tension like this or dislocation is, do you want to – should you move to new leadership or – you know, what's the best way of moving the company forward? Is it better to have a steady hand at the tiller? Well, I mean, what's Goyder done wrong at Woodside? I'm not sure. You know, the climate action plan needs to shift. Yep, fair enough. You know, is that doing something wrong? I don't know.
It's to do with the extent of accountability. How far should accountability go?
True.
Is it enough to step down from the company that you've mucked up at, or do you need to be accountable in general?
Yeah. Well, Goyder was in the paper, the AFR, yesterday saying, you know, really he's on the way out at Qantas, the AFL and Woodside. And I think the subtext was, you know, what more do you want from me? But maybe I'm reading too much into that.
Yeah. How come bank stocks are on the nose? What's going on?
Well, they're basically too expensive.
Yeah.
Frankly.
And I read a thing the other day saying that Commonwealth Bank is the most expensive bank in the world, which it is.
Yes, has been for a long time, yeah. It's our dividend-loving listeners, Alan, have bid these banks up. But the rise in the last little while has been quite impressive, last 6 months or so. And it's all been predicated on this bet that bank earnings will improve as interest rates come down. You know, that'll stimulate some some demand for credit growth as the housing market changes. But it's just not going to work out like that. And I think that's really what the analysts are saying. Basically, these bank stocks have become too expensive for us to recommend them in any way, shape, or form. Now, I don't expect that to result in a wave of selling of bank stocks, but it's just a bit of a warning that, you know, if you're thinking of buying into these banks, in the coming days, weeks, or months, they're pretty damn expensive.
I think that the thing to note when things are expensive like this, and I think it goes for a lot of the share market at the moment, is that the returns over the next 5 years are not what they were before. You can't expect the same sort of returns when you buy something that's expensive. I mean, whether or not they sort of fall significantly, you know, who knows? But that's really the thing, isn't it? I mean, you're probably going to get dividends and not much else for the next 5 years.
Yeah. There's a theory in markets called equity risk premium, which is basically is the dividend yield of the equity markets versus the 10-year bond yield. And, you know, that has got very, very low. In the US, it's basically zero, which says that you're taking to get the same return out of, you can get the same return out of bonds with a lot less risk. And that's the question for equity market investors. Like, what's the risk reward at the moment?
You're not being, another way to put that is you're not being paid much to take risk in shares.
That's a much better way to push it.
Well, it's just, because the equity risk premium is what you're getting paid for taking risk.
Yeah. And it's been like that for a while. I mean, we've seen a sort of half a correction in the last week or so. That doesn't feel necessarily unhealthy. It might not feel nice, but it doesn't necessarily feel unhealthy.
Oh, no, that's right. Markets correct all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, I read something yesterday saying, we're doomed for a correction. Well, yeah, we're always doomed for a correction in the share market. That's what happens.
Yeah, it's true. That's true.
And just before we move to questions, I saw with interest the other day that Macquarie's getting out of car lending so I can focus on mortgages. So you follow Macquarie a fair bit. I mean, they are really having a go at mortgages, aren't they?
Oh, totally. Oh, I mean, they've had a go.
They're obviously continuing on and going to press on with it.
Oh, totally. Yeah, I think that's right. For them, it's good margin business. You know, they don't have branches. They've got a really good technology stack. So they're in a different position to some of the big banks. And car loans has become a pretty low margin, pretty tough business in recent years. So this looks to be a pretty sensible trade-off.
How are their mortgages priced? I mean, should our listeners think about taking out a mortgage with Macquarie? Are they competitively priced?
Yes, they are competitively priced, Alan, but they do look for a certain type of customer. I would describe them as a more premium, more wealthy type of customer. The theory being there, of course, that those customers are a lot less likely to default or less likely to default. So they can take a little bit more. They can offer more competitive pricing because they're surer of their bad debts. But they're definitely competitive, and that's been one of the great advantages that they've used their big balance sheet to be really competitive on pricing.
Mm. Fascinating. Okay, yeah, well, let's go to questions. Before we do that, let's have a quick word from our sponsor.
InvestSmart's portfolios are turning 10. To celebrate, 10 InvestSmart boot camps are up for grabs. This self-paced online course is ideal for both seasoned investors and those just starting out. Valued at $99, you could win a spot on this highly rated course. To enter the competition and for terms and conditions, simply visit investsmart.com.au/win. Don't miss out on this chance to learn from the experts and take your investing to the next level. Visit investsmart.com.au/win. Good luck.
Okay, first question from Manuela, who says, ever since you started reporting on the price of cocoa, my partner cannot also stop buying chocolate. How can I stop him with these irrational cocoa-based purchases? Might not be that irrational, really, because I think it's a bubble what's going on in cocoa. It got up to $12,000 a ton. It's come down 10% in recent weeks. But I don't know if the bubble's worse. The question, it's an interesting question, really, and what's going on with cocoa, because if it's to do with climate change, and the reason that the price is up is because 3 years in a row the harvests have been disrupted by rain in Africa, they don't bless the rains in Africa, as Toto would say. Anyway, it might be permanent. I mean, if it's climate change, then the problems might not go away.
Yeah.
And demand has not stopped at all. And I think it's interesting because I think that the demand for chocolate doesn't seem to be elastic in the sense that it responds to price. Everyone just buys it, no matter what the price.
I have noticed, though, Alan, that the size of one's bar has continues to gently shrink. So that might be how how big chocolate is handling this issue.
Yeah.
But I think Manuela's just got to leave her partner. There's no other. He's lost it. And no.
All right.
No, I'm kidding. Are you suggesting though that maybe he's hoarding chocolate for future price rises?
Yeah, maybe he'll maybe he's going to set up a stall out the front of the house.
Fantastic, love it. Emma says, would have to politely correct Stephen from last week. Australia's nicest CEO was Andrew Cole, the CEO of Oz Minerals, which has been acquired by BHP. Very respected guy. While on the topic of mining, would be keen to hear your thoughts on rising copper exports from Australia and whether copper could ever rival or overtake coal as our main export.
What do you reckon?
Well, copper is having an absolute ball terror at the moment. It's up 25%. Since the middle of February. And the issue here is that everybody is waking up again to the fact that there's just not enough of the stuff in the world. So most of the easy-to-get copper supply has been got, and now we're looking for copper in harder places, whether that's further underground or more fraught jurisdictions. And at the same time, demand keeps going up. Now, demand's going up in part because global manufacturing's getting off the canvas, but also because green investing or renewables and other green investments need to continue almost irrespective of what economic conditions are doing. And the other thing that's going on is data centers with this artificial intelligence boom. We're building a lot more data centers, and that's going to add about 500,000 tons of copper demand over the next couple of years. The world consumes about 26 million tons of copper every year. So the story for copper is very good, and Australia's really well placed. BHP has always had good copper production out of Olympic Dam, but as Emma said, they bought Oz Minerals, which is basically in the same area, in that South Australian area. BHP's plan is to turn sort of Olympic Dam into a bit of a copper hub and build a big, not quite a size of the Pilbara, but a copper province in that area. And BHP is quietly excited about this. It's starting to come together. So maybe by value terms, eventually copper exports could rival coal, over the next few decades.
I think there's nothing surer, actually. Yeah. I mean, coal, we have to stop exporting coal. Well, people have to use, the world has to stop using coal.
Yes, so, over time, yeah.
Net zero by 2050 means no coal.
Yeah.
Well, not much coal, hardly any. Yeah. So copper will definitely overtake it. Yaz says, do you think that markets are underestimating the risk of widespread civil unrest? There's a couple of questions about the US and Trump here, so we might just deal with them both.
Yeah.
Yaz is talking about civil unrest in the US following the presidential election. No matter which candidate wins, it seems possible the US could be facing a lot of very unhappy people taken to the streets, many of whom will be armed to the teeth, leading to violence or domestic terrorism. And Stephen says, Alan, you made a comment about the possibility of Trump being re-elected. Having grown up in Canberra, I recently became a US citizen living in sunny Arizona. After I arrived, I was surprised to discover that my church is comprised of hardline Trump supporters. And when I asked about this, they were quick to ignore the clear moral and character issues and instead described how the minority groups and associated ideologies seem to be taking over the country. So he reckons Trump's going to win, I think. Doesn't he say that? Yeah.
Yeah.
He says, I think he's going to smoke Biden because this time he's not the incumbent and does not have to have anything. So I would have thought if the Trump supporters lose, then they'll be angrier and more armed to the teeth than the Biden supporters. But I agree that whoever wins, there's going to be some unhappiness.
There's going to be lots of unhappiness, but there's lots of unhappiness now. I mean, America is a very divided place. The betting has Donald Trump just in front, but it's only just, so I think it's pretty close. Ray Dalio's got this sort of, idea of the history of the world, and he's sort of an amateur historian. He's a big hedge fund investor in the US. And his point is that, you can get international tensions, but almost as damaging are domestic tensions or domestic divisions. And you could see a pretty bad outcome out of this election. We saw a pretty ugly outcome out of the last election. So, and to Yaz's point, there was armed insurrection. It ended pretty quickly, but those scars are still pretty real. Now, what does that mean for sort of markets? Good question. The history of impacts of civil strife or even war on markets shows that the bad period tends to be pretty short. You know, there is an initial shock, but markets tend to get over those shocks pretty quickly, with some exceptions. But so, you know, markets might just sort of trade through, and they might even, with Trump, look to the positives and say, hey, this guy will cut taxes and increase subsidies for certain sectors, and away we go. That was the surprise when Trump won in 2016, that markets were supposed to tank and instead they soared.
Yeah, that's right. I think also it's hard. I just personally think it's hard to believe that America will vote for Trump, but, you know, anything's possible, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. John says, love the show. I can buy a two-bedroom apartment up to $850,000 within affordable payments. Should I do it? Currently renting at $525 a week and moving to a $900 a week mortgage. Alan, I've got no idea what advice to offer John, but I'm interested that in this equation that must be confronting lots of people trying to move from renting to buying.
Yes, well, look, the history would tell you that the absolute thing you should do is buy a house whenever you can, because it tends to, or it has grown over the past 20 years at 6% per annum, 6 or 7% per annum. And if you live in the house, it's tax-free. So, you know, it's really the basic investment that everyone should make, tax-free investment that grows at 6 or 7% per annum. The question is it going to keep doing that? And it's not really just an issue of whether all of the talk about housing affordability will turn into action, because it never has in the past. There's been tons of talk about housing affordability and everyone trying to do something about it. It's really a question of can house prices keep rising at this rate over the long term? I question whether that's possible, really. I think that you get to a point, it's like in the share market and banks. We were talking about banks before being expensive. And therefore, you know, the return over the next 5 or 10 years is not going to be great because they're expensive now. Hmm. And I think that applies to housing, to be honest. I mean, I don't know. And who knows, you know, housing just keeps going up. But I suppose my instinct would be that, you know, in 50 years' time or 20 years' time even, we'll look back on the period from 2000 to, 2025 or something, 2024, as an aberration of 2 decades when house prices rose quickly for various reasons and then stopped rising quickly.
Okay.
Does that mean you should rent instead of buy? You could see a situation where house prices just rise with incomes at 3 or 4% in the CPI, 3 or 4%, and that's still okay. As a kind of a tax-free investment, that's fine, really. And the other thing about owning rather than renting is that you're in control of the place. You know, you don't have to. You're not going to be booted out. I don't think tenants in Australia have a lot of power. You know, there have been some efforts to redress the power imbalance between tenants and landlords, but it hasn't gone far enough in my view. And so the other reason for owning a house is so that you don't get booted out of it.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, tough one. But I think it's a question that lots of people will be thinking about in the next little while.
Jacob says he's got a helpline, and it's interesting. I've got a helpline which I've paid off as of January this year, and it's calculated based on my monthly deduction from my salary. Despite this, I'll still have to pay indexation for this for the rest of the year. The money doesn't get applied to the helpline until after the individual submits the end of year tax return, meaning that the ATO gets to charge indexation before applying the already paid money to the loan. And this means that I'll be out of pocket for interest on the money already paid. It's not such a big deal for me, as this will be my last tax year with a helpline, but for our fellow Aussies with large helplines, this means that they go backwards every year. It's interesting. I mean, I think that is an issue. He's raised it with his local MP, not much luck in resolving it. I wanted to hear your thoughts on the issue and raise awareness so our useless pollies actually do something about the issue. Well, I'm sure our useless pollies are all listening to this podcast and maybe they can do something about it. What do you think of that,
James? Well, look, Alan, we've had a lot of hex questions. I remember there was one very persistent questioner, and we dismissed them with the point that, well, nobody was whinging about this when inflation was, you know, two-tenths of stuff all. I still think that's points right, but, I think I've changed my tune a bit in that there's a few anomalies like the one Jacob's described here. The question of whether it should be the wage price index rather than CPI I think is a very reasonable one. I think we just need to it feels like a system in need of a cleanup. And the government has promised to have, in inverted commas, more to say on this in the coming weeks. So maybe Jacob and others will get a bit of guidance in the federal budget.
Yep.
Kieran says, I graduated university at the end of 2023. Over the past year, due to my personal preference and the place in which I work, I'm required to work primarily on site. This is great. I can pester my co-workers with questions and make in-person connections. One thing I've noticed now in my second year, though, is the preference of fresh graduates to work from home. I hadn't really heard about it, but do you think we're neglecting neglecting in-work education for the future workforce as well as future productivity by promoting work from home? Some of my best teachers are less tech-savvy and hard to get on Teams. Cheers for the podcast and the 7 p.m. ABC Finance segment. This is a really interesting question.
I think, the world has changed. I mean, everyone, a lot of people work from home now, a lot of the time. And so you probably do too, do you, James?
Yes, I do a bit. But
you've got nothing to learn from anybody, right?
No, that's never true. But I do really value coming into the office because of the conversations we have and the leads you get and the information you get and the ideas you get from people. I think it's essential. And I think back to when I started, Alan, sort of 25 years ago in this business, I reckon the first 2 years I learned a lot of stuff by overhearing people in the office and the way they dealt with issues. So the way other journalists talk to each other, the way they talk to contacts, the way they talk to, PR people who weren't being unhelpful or PR people who were being unhelpful. So much of it is in journalism. It's sort of an apprenticeship culture. You learn by listening and seeing and osmosis. And I think Kieran's right. It's okay. Yeah, working from home's going to work for some people, but not in some sectors where that style of learning is important.
Yeah, I agree.
I've talked to people in professional services. An accountant with 4 years' experience pre-COVID is definitely different to an accountant with 4 years' experience post-COVID, because the post-COVID accountant, young accountant, has not spent the same time in the office.
It's interesting. I think the other thing that isn't getting a lot of discussion is the psychological benefit of actually having, in a sense, two lives. I mean, when you go into the office, you're a kind of a different person. I mean, everyone's the same, obviously, but you have a different set of friends, different life there, and you have these two separate existences. But if you don't go into the office, all your existence just kind of becomes one thing. And I do think that there's a benefit to being able to, escape one of the two lives and go to the other one.
Yeah, I agree. As for the productivity question, Danielle Wood, the productivity commissioner, has looked into this, is looking at this, is really interested in it. She came to one of our summits and quoted this really interesting study where they looked at a big firm of software engineers, and they found that working from home increased the productivity of the business because all the senior software engineers weren't bothered by people like Kieran pestering them with questions. So, but as Wood says, the question is, do you pay for that initial productivity increase down the track when those senior executive, when those senior software engineers leave the business and the junior ones just haven't got the same level of experience because they haven't been able to learn via osmosis? So there's lots of studies going on, but we're too early in the work from home revolution to know. But it's definitely one to think about.
It's worth noting that productivity in Australia, at least, and elsewhere, I think, as well, has declined a lot since the pandemic.
Yeah.
And I do think that's partly because of working from home. I mean, I don't agree this, but I'd be really interested to see the Productivity Commission studies on this,
yeah,
and how they come down with it. But I reckon that part of the reason productivity has declined is because if people are working from home and then picking up the kids and, you know, basically slacking off.
Yeah, I'm an optimist on all this, though. I think it'll find its right rhythm and right balance. I mean, I think for some people, particularly women, working from home and being able to do other things like, you know, use breaks to pick up the kids that's really helpful. And men do the same thing.
Absolutely.
But I think the balance between in office or at work and at home we'll find the right solution here over time. We're just going through a period of change, so I'm positive.
Patrick says, I'd like to hear your thoughts on the best way to foster an interest in money, wealth, and investing in children and teenagers. My wife and I spent our 20s traveling, wasting money on dead-end careers, cars, etc. Now in our late 30s, we find ourselves playing catch-up. We've been fortunate to buy our first home 2 years ago, buy shares in a business, and we are seeing the reward in investing smartly. We have two young children now, and given the current economic climate, I'm fearful that they may do the same. We'd love to hear your thoughts. What did you do in your 20s, James? Did you waste money on dead-end careers and cars and travelling?
A little bit of travelling, but I didn't. Yeah, no, I was. I think we bought relatively early, my wife and I. So,
right.
But look, in terms of two young children, I don't know. It's always hard. There's books you can read. The Barefoot Investor's got one for kids, and there's lots of good tips in that. Scott Pape, he does a great job. The simple thing, I reckon, this might sound stupid, Alan, but my wife does the grocery shopping and sometimes I do it too, but she almost always likes to take one of the kids. It's great to have a bit of time with the kids walking around the shops, but I reckon it's also gets them into the sort of the real world of how the family budget comes together. They get to see how the pricing works, you know, where the bill is at the end of the week. It's just a little view into, you know, the stuff doesn't arrive at home for free. I don't know. Maybe that's a silly example, but I think it's just sort of stuff like that of exposing the kids to spending and saving that probably helps.
Yes. I'm afraid I wasted my 20s and traveling and everything. I mean, I didn't waste on it. Well, dead-end careers? No, not really. But look, and my kids, what do my kids do? They didn't buy their houses until they didn't buy their first house until they're all in their 30s. And I think it's true that they would have been better off if they bought 10 years earlier. That's true. So if you can persuade your children to buy a house in their 20s or help them do it, then that'd be good for them. That's true. I mean, I think just talking to them about it is the way to go, probably.
Yeah, exactly. More talking you do, the better. Colin says, what are your opinions on whether we're returning to a period of economic feudalism whereby ownership of property will be the primary indicator of wealth and opportunity? Whilst I don't think we're there yet, all the indicators are that we're in a generation are that within a generation or two, we'll be back to those who own property or derive wealth from it and can benefit them from the opportunities allows and those who have none. What do you reckon, Alan? You're the expert here.
Oh, well, I think we're definitely changing. The increase in house prices over the past 25 years has certainly changed the way Australia works and the, you know, how you get on. You've got to own property. No, you certainly, the people who have owned property over the past 25 years have certainly got more money. and more wealth. That's right. So if it stays as it is and there's, you know, house prices keep rising, then I think it's true that we're getting to a situation where the ownership of property is what it's all about. As to whether that means feudalism, I don't know. I mean, that's probably going a bit far. I mean, it used to be that those who owned property had the vote, nobody else. Only people who owned property were able to vote, and we're not going back to that, of course. So look,
well, I think the point about housing haves and have nots that Collins makes is real, and I think that's the case now.
Yeah, it is the case now. And if your family is in, you know, owns a house, and then you're able to leverage that, either inherited or people, your parents are able to use their equity to help you into a house, then that's great. But if you're not in that situation, then you're out of business. You're in trouble.
Time for one more, Alan. You can choose.
Yeah, I'm just trying to choose. Damien says, I've recently discovered your podcast and have spent the past few weeks devouring all the previous episodes. Good on you. I've been holding shares in battery manufacturer at Redflow for a few years now, although through various capital raisings and so on. I have a question about their latest capital raising. On this occasion, they are offering one share for every two shares you have in the company, but they are also including one free attaching unlisted option, exercisable at 20 cents and expiring on 15th of April 2026 for every two new shares subscribed. What does this mean? Why are they doing it? And what are options anyway? I've never had an option on shares before, and I'm not sure if they are a benefit or even what to do with them. You can put him right, can't you, James?
Oh, I'll do my best, Alan.
So, well, an option just gives you the right to buy the things in, at 20 cents before 15th of April 2026.
Yeah, and I think in this case, it appears to me to be a little incentive, I guess, the idea would be that that Redflow shares will be worth a lot more than 20 cents, or the hope will be that Redflow shares will be a lot more than 20 cents by the time we hit that date. And then our correspondent will be able to exercise their option and have a little profit.
And buy at 20 cents. The trouble is that the shares are 11 cents at the moment, so they're not worth buying at 20 cents, right?
Yes. Those options are not worth exercising, but Redflow is saying here, well, hey, stick with us for the next 2 years and we think we'll get our share price up and you'll be able to make a profit exercising those options.
And when you exercise the options, you'll be giving them 20 cents
per share. But you'll be getting hopefully a share worth more than that in return.
That's right. And you can Damien, you can actually go onto the market and buy options. That instead of them getting them for nothing off Redflow like this, you can actually buy an option, and it'll depend on the kind of conditions of it and the share price and what the strike price of the options are as to what you end up paying for it.
Anyway, it looks to me, Alan, in this entitlement offer that the attaching unlisted options are sort of used as a bit of a extra incentive to get investors interested in this capital raising. The capital raising is to fund the delivery of announced projects, key engineering developments, and Redflow is going to scale up its Thailand manufacturing facility. This is Redflow needs money to keep the shop ticking over and keep growing. This is what the money's for. And the options are a little sweetener, I think, to get the capital raising away.
And that's it for today. Sorry about the questions that we weren't able to answer. We routinely get more questions than we can possibly answer, which is great. But anyway, please send the questions in. Send them to themoneycafe@eurekareport.com.au. I'll be back next week with Stephen Main, and we'll answer them then. Until then, I'm Alan Kohler, founder of Eureka Report. Thanks for listening to today's episode of The Money Cafe.
And I'm James Thompson, senior Chanticleer columnist at The Australian Financial Review.